Hey guys, this week's episode is brought to you by Social Print Studio. We've been ordering that personalized page a day calendar from them every Christmas since 2015, way before they were podcast sponsors, but they've got tons of other photo products too. Plus, you can get 15% off your order with code YHL15 now through December 9th. Just go to socialprintstudio.com/YHL to get started. I'm John.
And I'm Sherry.
We like home stuff.
We like talking.
And we like the occasional game show sound effect. So welcome to Young House Love Has a Podcast, where we have deep and not so deep conversations about DIY, design, and life at home.
Today we're sharing how we keep a handle on all of the drawings, paintings, and other crafty creations our kids make, plus what kicked my houseplant obsession into overdrive, and how things got weird when we switched sides of the bed. You guys might want to start calling me the plant lady now, because ever since that episode with Carmion, it was episode 149, I've been buying plants with reckless abandon.
Sherry has never had such a kick in the pants from one of her own episodes, I think.
Truly, it is probably the single most influential episode that has like changed my actions right after recording it and sharing it.
Hashtag pats herself on the back.
It's more like, uh-oh, how many plants am I going to have a year from now? Because if you're looking at this like a bell curve of plants, I have a spike that continues to climb. Who knows when I'll plateau on the plant kick, but I'm very much excited.
I also feel like it's a marked contrast from where we've been in the last year or so, because for the duplex in the beach house, we've had to primarily purchase faux plants. So you had been purchasing lots of faux plants, but it's like this has steered you back on course to real plants.
Right. Well, out there, there are many weeks we're not out there for 3-4 weeks at a time. So even a pothos does not tolerate that. And I don't want plants like dropping leaves or like potentially getting buggy or any sort of issue at a house we're not in for almost a month at a time. But after talking to Carmion, I've been much more inspired. If I'm at Kroger and there's a $6 giant, huge, happy pothos, I bring that baby home and I make it mine.
She's like, I'm a plant lady. It's my duty.
I name it now. I put it in a
pot. You do?
Well, in my head. They usually are named after what they look like. Like I've got Pokey and Droopy.
They're like the seven dwarves of plants.
Yeah, I have Spiky 1 and Spiky 2. They live near each other in the kitchen.
Weren't you a namer?
Get a kick out of these really bad plant names.
Like professionally you named products and all you can come up with is Spiky 2.
One actually is Mick Jagger though, because he has like kind of hair. He's a plant with hair.
Okay.
But anyway, what I'm making a point to say is that you might get in a rut at home, right? And we can do this in any number of ways. Like we might get in a cooking rut or a cleaning rut. I was in a faux plant rut, let's say. And I really am excited to be shattering the boundaries of that. And I don't also want to toot my horn about this because it sounds like I'm going to jinx myself, but every single plant I've brought in, and I've probably doubled my plants. I think I had maybe 15 real plants in the house before. Now I have 30 and all of them are alive and thriving. Like nobody has drooped, lost leaves. It's been a few weeks. They could have started to decline and everybody looks very happy to see me.
Well, I think the other thing that has motivated you, and we talked a little bit about this in the episode with Carmion, is that indoor plants help your indoor air quality. And now that we're like entering a season of the year in which a lot of the plants outside are looking more dead and brown, and we're spending a lot more time inside, like it seems like a good time to sort of bring that life inside and like boost that air quality.
Yes, like 10 years ago, I wrote a post on the blog. I will link to it so you can laugh at what posts look like 10 years ago, because I think it has like two tiny pictures. But NASA came out with this study of like the 10 plants that clean the air in your house the most. And the funny thing is, if you Google this, you find 10 different plants in many different lists. So I don't know if NASA did multiple studies or if there are just a lot of good plants, but there are probably 15 to 20 plants that get shouted out by NASA in varying places. And I was researching after Carmion and I was inspired to get all these plants. So I knew which plants were easy according to Carmion, but I was like, wait, I should probably cross-reference that with ones that are good for the air. And what happened was I came across a few articles that discussed how many plants you ideally would have in your home per room for your square footage. Like if you have a small apartment, the number of plants you might need. If you have a larger house, the number of plants you might need to get these maximum benefits of it purifying the air and sucking gross things out. Some plants can even take formaldehyde out of the air. Like they're kind of amazing little worker bees in the background.
Plus you want them to have a friend in the room. Like they can't be alone.
Right. Spiky needs Pokey.
You need Spiky too.
But anyway, the general consensus of these articles was that for every 10-foot by 10-foot space you had in your home, so like 100 square feet, one plant would purify that air. And of course, there are probably different plants that do it more efficiently. The size of the plant probably matters. But I like a guideline and I like a goal. So I set out, because I was like, our house is around 3,000 square feet. I need 30 plants. And I counted my plants and I had about 15. And I worked slowly to build it up to 30. I think now I've got 32 because I just couldn't stop myself. And every single pot that I have used, I have already owned. And you might say, how? You just had empty pots? Well, I had a few empty pots over the years that I picked up at IKEA. I love their white ceramic pots. They're just very classic. But I also had some fake plants in pots that I demoted. So I plucked out the little fake plants. They're all in a cabinet now. And they've got real plants in those pots. So it has felt like very much like an upgrade. Even the guest room, the bonus room, bathrooms.
The kids' rooms.
The kids' rooms. Yes, I went with the kids to Home Depot and they each picked out their own plants for their room. And they were so into it. They like took their time and made sure they made the right decision to pick the best plant for them. It was really cute. And they nurture them and talk to them just like I do. So I'm creating plant lovers.
Hopefully they have better names.
I think they do have better names. I think they actually have middle and last names too.
You should take a note.
I really should. But anyway, I'm encouraging all of you, if you listened to that podcast and thought about getting plants, it really has given me a lot of joy. And I am a nervous plant owner, but I've been having a lot of luck. And in the show notes, I'll put some pictures to some of the ones I got. I'll link to my favorite planters. And I will show you some varieties I found that are beyond the ones that Carmion recommended. But I took the time to read the labels and make sure they were easy care and didn't need a lot of light and didn't need fancy stuff. And they all have been doing so well. There's a particular one I'm thinking of in the bedroom. Can't think of the name right now, but I have the tag. It's gorgeous and big. And I just feel better about spending a lot of time in these rooms now. It almost feels like it's like a me time, like I'm giving myself a gift and it's pure air and real living plants.
Well, speaking of giving a gift, I'll say that the episode inspired me to make a change because instead of giving flowers as gifts, like for instance, my godmother's birthday was last month and we typically send her like a food basket or flowers or something. And instead, I ordered her a potted plant.
It's going to last forever. I love it.
Well, it lasts longer than food and flowers. So I gave the gift of indoor air quality. How about that?
Look at you.
You guys know that that sound means we have an update, and this one comes from episode 151, where we talked about sides of the bed, and we had challenged ourselves to switch sides of our bed so that we would sleep on the other person's side for a week. And I will report, I think we did it for more like 10 days. We overachieved for once on a challenge.
And everybody has been wondering how this went. Just kidding, not a single person has asked me.
No, I don't think people are that curious, but I felt like we needed to close the loop. So it'll be a quick update.
The first few days, I actually slept hard. I don't know if it was just luck because we were tired and doing a lot for the bathroom, but I woke up and I was like, there's something to it. Because remember, we learned that a sleep specialist had told someone who had trouble sleeping that she should switch spots with her husband, lay down where her feet are, up where her head is, like kind of move around in the bed so she's in an unexpected place. But switching sides gave me that feeling of kind of like disoriented. Maybe I slept more deeply. At least it felt that way when I woke up for the first few days.
Well, see, I had the opposite experience. We haven't talked about this, by the way.
Right. This is us revealing to each other how this felt.
I mean, at first I'll say that it was not that hard to switch. Like the actual act of moving our nightstand stuff, I was like, I don't know why we thought this was a big deal. But I think the first few nights I actually slept worse than I typically do because it did disrupt my usual like sleeping patterns. Like I usually sleep on this side, but now I have to sleep on this side, and my body had trouble figuring that out.
I thought you'd fall on the floor, and not once did you.
I didn't do that, although I did slap you in the middle of the night, didn't I? Or
no, I slapped you.
Because I think, I elbowed you.
You elbowed me later on. In the early stages, like the third night is when I was like, maybe this is not as great as I thought. Because remember, the first two nights I was flying high. I thought, I'm sleeping better than ever. And then on the third night, I rolled over. And John's never near me in the bed. We've discussed this. He's always hugging the edge. And I was pulling my weighted blanket, which you know is like a punch. It's a lot of effort to pull your weighted blanket and roll over. And John's face was there. So I kind of like open hands slapped his face because I didn't expect him to be so close to me, facing me. He didn't wake up.
Yeah, good news, guys. I survived it. I didn't even wake from my slumber.
I thought he did because he like moved enough that I was like, uh-oh. And in the morning, I was like, sorry about punching you. And he was like, what?
So, maybe that's why I didn't have a good night's sleep the first few nights.
I don't know. I only punched you the third night.
Okay. Well, I think I did get used to it in a few days, like towards the end of the week. My body was starting to adjust. And even my like routines of like where I walked to at night when we were getting into bed and like, I quickly got used to the new scenario, which I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing. So I think that's one reason why we kind of like just kept it going longer than we needed to, because it so quickly became the new routine.
I think it started to get old towards the end for me, like maybe day 7. I was like, I really want to switch back because I felt like you didn't quite know spatially where you were in the bed.
Yes, it was very confusing for my body.
And I never spatially know where I am in the bed, but there's usually such a wide girth because John's hugging the edge that I can bebop all around the bed. And I felt like you were kind of up in my bebop in space.
Right. Never more did we need a king-size bed than when we switched sides.
Right. And so then when we switched back, immediate release of the pressure. Like, yes. I had the whole bed again. Yes. I could move around and wiggle to my heart's content.
Status quo was great. Well, and the good news is now everyone listening can rest easier now that they know the conclusion to
this. Right. They all were asking me.
Yes. Whether you've switched sides or not, now you have this info about how it went for us.
Literally no one asked me.
Which is why we made a 5-minute podcast segment about it.
John likes to close a loop. Even if no one else wants to close the loop, he will do it.
I was curious about how your night went. I know we could have talked about it without a microphone in front of us.
Yes. Now that we've unpacked all this information, we can move on.
Yes. To a segment we haven't done in a while, which is called, well, that's embarrassing.
So this is a unique story because it doesn't involve me. It involves my friend, and it was so funny. I said, can I share this on the podcast? And she said, it must be shared. The people must know. The story is the best. I couldn't wait to tell you guys. I was moving pieces around in our bedroom way back in August, the end of August. I moved our dressers around, and I was sharing it on Instagram. And then later, I saw my friend, and she was like, dude, I just have to tell you a moving furniture story. And she explained that she got trapped in their bedroom, literally, legit trapped, could not escape, because she moved a tall dresser into the hall. It got wedged like between the door jamb and the hall, and she basically blocked herself into the room with this tall dresser. And she could not move it. And this is a friend who's strong and not quite flappable, but she was flapped. Like, she was panicking. And, of course, she didn't have her cell phone in the room to expedite her escape. So she had to wait in the room, stuck, for a significant amount of time.
Without a cell phone, which is tough these days.
Right, she just sat there until her husband returned home. And she had to be like, help, help, I'm in here, behind the dresser. And he had to move the dresser to get her out. And she said it was her most embarrassing / humbling moment of marriage to date.
It makes me think of my grandmother, who is known to just reorganize the furniture in her living room at a moment's notice. And so you'll come over and suddenly it's like completely rearranged. And you're like, how did this 90-year-old woman do this all by herself?
It's amazing. She fully moves entire rooms.
She has wider doorways, I guess we should say.
She's never gotten stuck once.
Not that we know of, at least. Maybe she called someone else.
And I figured I can't just share someone else's embarrassing story. So I'm going to tack mine on at the end. It is more of like a lucky / embarrassing story because it has an embarrassing point and then a point at which I feel very fortunate for the outcome. So it involved the duplex this summer. It was in between renters. We had this small window of time between everybody on Saturday when the guests had left, but the new guests hadn't arrived.
Yep.
And we'd run around refilling stuff and checking stuff. And I was realizing, oh, I should dust, this is my neurosis showing, I should dust the rails of the pocket door. Because I assumed, you know, we have people who help us with cleaning, but the pocket door is always pushed into the wall when they come in and clean.
Right. You're talking about in one of the upstairs bedrooms, there's just a pocket door.
Exactly. It's like the whale room or the oranges room.
Right, with the wallpaper.
Yes. Two little twin beds, pocket door, and it's always in the wall when the cleaners come. And I was like, I should open this. Oh my gosh, what if there's a bunch of like dust on the ledges? There wasn't, but I was like just getting them
clean. What a bad review about the dusty door.
I just wanted to check. You know, like every single time I went in there, I thought of a different random thing to check and I would take it upon myself. And so as I was pulling the door out, it got a little stuck in the wall. You guys know pocket doors. They're not always a breeze. In my head, when this happened in slow motion, I thought, I shouldn't pull this too hard or I will slam my hand because I was holding the edge of the pocket door and the edge of the pocket door hits the wall when it's fully opened. So I yanked ever so slightly and bang, like the door released like butter, flew open, And I was like, wait, why isn't my hand in splitting pain? Like the door bounced against the doorway and opened again, like as if it slammed the doorway and opened again. But my hand had been in the way and I felt no pain in my hand.
You have a miracle hand.
I was like, an angel stopped that. It hit an angel's hand and bounced back open. There was no explanation. I looked down and it hadn't hit my foot. Like it smashed and opened, but my hand, which was in the way completely, did not get smashed.
Yeah, you were just happy it was fine. So you moved on.
Right. I kept cleaning, completely forgot about the incident. We went to the beach. We met up with friends. We went to dinner. We walked all over town that night. And then I came home and we were climbing into the hot tub. That's me and John's routine at night. And I was telling him the story. It was when it just came back to me as I was stepping into the hot tub. And I said, dude, there was like an angel or something that saved me. And as I'm telling him the story, I'm looking at my hand where my hand would have gotten smashed. And I notice that my engagement ring is jacked up. Like the prongs are twisted. The stone is pushed in. Like the stone at any point the entire day could have fallen on the ground. It's loose. It's spinning around. The weird thing is my finger didn't feel pain. You'd assume like since it's around your finger, you'd
feel it. I got you
a
very indestructible high absorbency engagement ring. You're welcome.
It's just unexplainable still to me, like why it didn't register. It hit my ring and I went throughout my entire day with my stone like spinning around, could have skittered across the beach, could have lost it at dinner, could have lost it in the duplex and not gotten into the duplex for a week because there would have been renters there. And instead, I'm stepping into the hot tub, another place I could have lost it.
So not only did an angel keep your hand from getting hurt, but it also kept your diamond just barely attached to your hand for the rest of the day.
I know. It is amazing I didn't lose my diamond. We do have insurance, but I'm very attached to this exact ring because this is what John proposed to me with. So I'm glad it was fixable. We brought it to a jeweler. He fixed it while I wait because I don't even like to send it out. Like I like to always have it. The other funny thing is then the next week when I was cleaning the duplex, I looked at the door frame and like clear as day, there's this squished 4 dents from the prongs of my ring that smashed it. Oh, and you know what else? It was such a hard hit that the pocket door itself has a divot from my inside of my ring band. And yet I was looking down at my foot. I was looking all around. I was looking for angels.
So now we're going to get bad reviews about the dust on the door and the dings in the door and the door frame.
Well, now if you stay in the side with the green doors, you will see in the door edge a little straight line. That's my ring pushing in. And in the door frame, you'll see the prongs where it's smashed. I'm probably going to fix them before the main summer season.
I don't think we will.
Maybe we'll leave them there for prosperity.
A little Easter egg for people who listen to the podcast and stay at the duplex.
Exactly.
Next up, we wanted to answer a listener question.
Yes. It came by DM from someone named Lisa, and she said, I love the recent podcast about not wanting to become a stuff manager, and I even had my husband listen to it. But one struggle I have right off the bat is the amount of crafts and art projects that my kids turn out. One child isn't into toys really much at all, but is constantly creating. I feel like I'm swimming in construction paper and scotch tape projects that are each precious to her. I've noticed your kids seem equally creative and crafty, and I wondered how you handled weeding through their output. I have a special keep box for each child, and it's pretty easy for me to tell which artwork I would like to keep, but she wants to keep literally everything. Any advice is appreciated.
Can I put a disclaimer up front that if you've seen any of the mess that we have sometimes around our office where our kids do their craft or at the beach house where they work, like I think crafting is inherently messy for kids.
Right. While they're creating it, the room explodes. To me, that's part of the creative process. I, as a kid, loved art. I had like paper mache in my room. So I'm okay with a big mess. We also let them like cook and the counter gets all messy, but it's part of the creating process.
Yeah. So I don't think what we're answering here is like how to keep it clean when they're doing these things. She's asking specifically about how do you sort through the end creations and know what to keep and what to throw away, because I think we can relate to the idea that like kids sometimes think everything they make is precious and that everything should be kept and hung on the fridge and framed and all these things when you physically don't have room in your house or on your walls to do that.
Right. Like our house would fill up with paper and we would only have to live upstairs and couldn't come downstairs if we kept every piece of paper our kids created with. So a long time ago, I figured out what worked for us. I don't know if it'll work for everyone, but I'm tossing out what works for us in the hopes that it might help. I bought each kid a Tupperware bin. This is not like a keepsake box for me, the parent. I have those upstairs. These are active storage spots for their creations. And they're probably like 18 inches by 16 inches with a lid. And the kids are responsible for sort of managing these. They know that that's where they can put all their creations. Once they make something, it goes in the bin. And that's basically their spot for favorites. What happens is everything goes in the bin because everything's a favorite, right? But then when it starts to get tight towards the top, I say, uh-oh, the bins are getting tight. I don't want your new creations to not have a spot to go. And what I've learned is newer things seem more precious to them than anything else. And I think their incentive, like their currency, is having more space in the bin for new stuff. And those old things that were precious when they made them, precious enough to be at the top of the bin, they end up lower and lower in the bin as they pile new creations on top. And instead of in the moment where everything they make is special, looking back on it later with sort of like hindsight, they can see what they really like the most.
Yeah, and to be clear, these are things that have already like not ended up in our storage keepsake box or haven't been displayed on the wall. So this is kind of like the middle to lower priority stuff, you know, like when they're just churning out sheets of comics or little drawings or stickers or stamps or paintings or whatever.
Right. That's a good point. I don't think this bin solution would work if you don't also have a place where you're showcasing all the favorites and keeping the really special things.
Yes, but I think that showcase spot works under the same principle of you have a finite amount of space. And between you and your child, or if your child is old enough, the child themselves can make the decisions about what goes on there. Like, we have that giant cork bulletin board in our office where they do their work. So there are places for them to pin stuff and save stuff that I think will have long-term meaning.
Right. And people might be picturing at home a little tiny cork board. Tell them the dimensions of this cork board.
Well, I don't know the exact thing, but it goes almost floor to ceiling between two windows. So it is, I don't know, 5 feet by 7 feet.
It's huge. So there is so much space for them to put stuff up. And I notice when I walk in, they are usually pinning something on top of something else. Like, yeah, it'll be 3 or 4 creations deep, and I'm okay with it.
But I think there are some subtle cues to them about it being a finite amount of space. Because, I mean, it literally is. Yes, they can do things multiple levels deep, but at some point it's going to be full. At some point there isn't going to be another pin on the board.
Right. It kind of polices itself because the pin will pop off the wall. There's too many things behind it, and they run out of pins.
Yeah, and I find that they will notice there isn't a free pin, and so they have that very basic decision of like, well, I've pinned this up, but if I need this pin to put my new thing up, I'm gonna have to take the old thing down. And so it is almost kind of a natural selection process that they go through. And I think it is just that fact of having a designated area, whether it's the display space or whether it's the bin where things are kept, and knowing that they're in charge of that and they're not going to get more.
Right. I think the key to it is it's their own agency.
Yeah.
They decide what stays. I'm never over their back saying, what about this? Or I don't think you need this, because I never want to be like naggy about creations and art. Another example is that in each of their rooms, I have frames where they put whatever they want. So like, there's something framed in our daughter's room, that's her art. There's something framed in our son's room, that's his art. When he says, oh, I want to frame this, he knows it displaces the other thing in the frame. It goes in his art frame in his room. They rotate those as they wish, and they have that designated space. So like, maybe a suggestion would not just be to get a bin, but to also get a designated frame in their room and a large cork board or some other display space. Another way I've seen people do it is they use like a long piece of twine with clothespins on it, and they clip them up along the wall. You could like hang a ribbon on the front or back of a door and clip things to the ribbon.
Well, even if you put it on your fridge or the side of your fridge, you could use like some washi tape or something just to designate an area that's their spot for their things on the fridge. Like, I think there are lots of ways, like you're saying, you can do this. It actually reminds me of a tip we got about sticking points from someone named Sarah. It wasn't about art, but she was saying they were having an issue with Legos being everywhere and it being a major frustration point for her, and also contention point between her and her kids when it was time to clean up the Legos.
Right, because they had been stored in their own rooms, the kids' rooms, and every single night it was this fight. They didn't want to, the Legos were everywhere, and it was like a point of tension and frustration for everyone.
Yeah, so Sarah said they moved the Legos to the playroom, or what they call their Lego room, so it's a space that can stay messy with stuff. But the thing that I thought was really smart, she said they also added a display shelf, or like a keep shelf, so the Lego creations that the kids wanted to hang on to, you know, they didn't want to break apart and put them back in the bin. Like, they didn't want them to be disassembled when it was cleanup time. Now they had a shelf where they could keep some things. So it helped them sort through what was precious enough to keep. And because it was a finite space, they had to make some decisions about what was going to be kept. And like you said earlier, for kids, a lot of the fun of this stuff is the creation process, and the things that they made a week ago become inherently less precious than the thing they just made or the thing they're about to make. And so I think it is a naturally filtering process because they're likely to disassemble the old thing so they can make room for the next.
Right. I just thought of one more thing. We also, inside their cubbies, we call it, or lockers. These are basically like cabinets near the door where they keep their shoes.
Yeah, our mini mudroom.
Right. I tape stuff up in there too. So I think we work a lot of places for their creations in, so they feel like there's a lot of them that share the spotlight and get like airtime, quote unquote. So it doesn't feel like a ton of it's in a bin or under the bed or thrown away. It feels like so much is in the display regions.
Yeah, I feel like at the core, a lot of the reasons why our kids want to hang on to everything they make is because they want it to feel precious and appreciated. And so I think as long as you have some places where that appreciation is shown, that checks the box.
Right,
in a lot
like
of ways.
Give them a gallery. Give them a Lego shelf or a frame in their room or a cork board or a mudroom cabinet or all of them.
Yeah.
Give them a lot of places they can put stuff up, and it's teaching them to sort of like decide when it's time to rotate the gallery. You're not in charge of the gallery. They're in charge of the gallery.
And it reminds me of another thing we get asked sometimes, because in addition to just art and paper crafts, like our kids like to make things out of cardboard boxes and forts and like all these creations that are a bit larger than a piece of paper and take up more room. But I think a similar principle applies to that as well. Partially, it is a finite space still. Like, there's a corner of the office next to our kids' desk where they keep a lot of their cardboard box creations. Like, if they've made a house for their lost kitties and dolls and all those things, like, that lives there. And they play with it for a little while, they forget about it, and then they get eager to create something new. So it's easy to say to them, well, you can, but this is the spot it goes. And so maybe we should move this one out of the way or get rid of this one so you can make a new one. And so far, we haven't ever really had resistance to that. I mean, it does mean that, yes, we will live for days with a giant cardboard box creation in the middle of the room that we do all of our work in.
Right.
So it's not like the most pristine Instagram-worthy Pinterest corner of our house or whatever.
Oh, I put it on Instagram sometimes just for fun. I get those comments that are like, how is your house so perfect? And I'm like, oh, let me flip the camera around and show you.
But I think the one challenge with forts, like when they're using your couch cushions to make a fort, is like you can't always wait for them to be over it before you need your couch back. Like, that happens to us sometimes at the beach house. Like, they love making forts in that living room. So the thing we use there instead of like the finite space is a finite time. So they know beforehand, like, if you're going to make a fort here, it can only stay up through tonight, or can stay up through the weekend, or whatever the finite amount of time is you decide, so that up front, they know that it's a limited time creation. And if that changes their decision about making it, so be it.
Spoiler alert, it never does, because the fun is making it. So even if I'm like, we have to take this apart in 2 hours, they're like, okay, we'll make it for 2 hours. It's still worth it.
Right. Well, it also makes you feel less like a bad guy when it comes time to tell them that it's time to take it down, because it's not a surprise. They've heard it from you. So there's less resistance at the end, because you can be like, hey guys, like we talked about, it's time to take the fort down.
Yeah, I think a lot of this, actually reflecting back, is just like setting up a system and them understanding the system from the get-go. Like, they understand the bins, they understand the fort. If we say like, hey, we're having people over tomorrow, we can't have like blankets and stuff all over the ground, they're like, okay, we know. And then there's really not much resistance at all, because it's like everybody knew.
And it's about you understanding that it's going to be messy. And that's fine.
Yeah. I would just end this by saying I would not trade having a clean house if it meant my kids were never creating stuff, because I love that they're doing that. I'm amazed that you can give them a pack of printer paper and 5 rolls of tape and it can keep them busy for 5 weeks. It's amazing.
Well, and you guys know that if you have a question you want us to answer on a future podcast, you can also leave us a voicemail if you don't want to message us on social media. That phone number is 571-4-YHL-HAP, as in Young House Love Has a Podcast, the longest acronym in the world. But it's good for a phone number, I guess.
571-4-YHL-HAP. Nailed it.
Anyways, next up we have We're Digging. I am digging something that has made a big impact.
Oh, that's a big clue, guys.
Yours makes an impact too.
It does.
But first, we're going to take a quick break. So I think it's very appropriate that Social Print Studio is sponsoring a podcast episode this time of year because November is the kickoff to Page a Day calendar season for me.
It is a whole season for John because John Thorough Petersick takes his calendar making duties very seriously.
This will be our fifth year buying their Page a Day calendar as Christmas gifts. So between us, my sisters, and some cousins, we corral 365 of our favorite family photos from the past year, and I assemble it into this awesome little Page a Day calendar. So it's like throughout the year, our whole family is enjoying the same new photo every day.
Yeah, and we give it to grandparents and our parents. Everybody loves it. And John even makes sure that every person has a photo of themselves on their birthday or anniversary, which is extra sweet.
Well, and this year is the first year you can order the calendar straight from their Print Studio phone app. The interface is super easy to use, and you can pull your photos right in from your phone's camera roll, and you don't have to touch your computer once.
Yeah, plus the calendar is only $45, and that's for 365 printed photos. So I feel like it's a great deal. Plus, you can take 15% off your order of anything on their site, not just the calendars, with the code YHL15. Visit socialprintstudio.com/YHL and enter the code YHL15 to get that 15% off.
So the thing that I'm digging this week is a tool that I bought myself because I've been thinking about it for a while and I realized the bathroom renovation was the right time. Like, now was the time. The tool I bought myself was an impact driver. It's kind of like a screwdriver, but it has some extra power to it, some extra torque. You know, like Tim Allen on Home Improvement, like more power, and then he grunts. I'm not going to do the grunts.
Thank you for that.
I already have a drill, so you may be wondering why I got it, but this extra torque helps a lot when you're doing things like installing new floors in your bathroom, whether it's the plywood subfloor or the cement board that you put the tile on. Like, it makes that process not only faster because it kind of pushes through the material much faster, but it also makes it less tiring on you. And I knew I was going to be doing a lot of it because, like, when you drill in cement board, you're supposed to put a screw like every few inches. So a single 3-foot by 5-foot cement board panel will have dozens of screws in it. And this is a big room. So I knew I was going to have to do a lot of this, and anything I could do to make that a little bit faster was worth it. So I got a $79 Ryobi impact drill that uses the same battery system for the rest of my tools. I will link it in the show notes because if you have a project coming up that has a lot of repetitive screwing in it, I realize how that sounds, but I'm leaving it in. I highly recommend this.
And what I'm digging is perfect because we're in the second week of November. November is Thanksgiving. It's all about sharing with people and doing good deeds. And I am digging this week doing good deeds with your children. It has been
not for your children.
No, with their help.
I mean, you should do that too.
We, through my doctor, fulfilled a Thanksgiving request. And it's basically these deserving families, you can fulfill their wish list for Thanksgiving. So each list is different of what they want. The list that we got, we wanted to fulfill the entire meal. And I brought my two kids to the store to do it with me. And I knew running around the grocery store alone would be much faster than doing it with the kids. But I really wanted to involve them. And they were so cute and so into it. Like, for a second, our youngest was like, wait, we're not getting this for us? Because, you know, one thing on the list is cookies and one thing on the list is hot chocolate. So it kind of seems like, wait, we're not getting our own cookies? But I explained, like, this is a family that really needs this. They wouldn't have anything to eat. And what can we do? We should pick the very best cookies we can find. We should pick the very best hot chocolate. And to watch my kids sit there and debate the merits of which hot chocolate was better was heartwarming. They were so serious about getting the right amount of ounces and the exact right stuffing the family had asked for. And the very last thing we did is we had to go to the pet store to get some food for Burger. And while we were there, we saw this bin that you could put food donations for a local animal rescue. It was called like the Animal Sanctuary of Richmond or something like that. And so I bought the dog food for our dog. We picked up an extra bag of dog food and the kids helped me put it in the bin to donate to this animal rescue organization. And it just made me so grateful to be able to do this with my kids.
Yeah, and it's a good reminder that it's something that we can do year round. But like this particular season, since it's a time where we are kind of reflecting on the things that we're grateful for having and how we can reach out to others, like, it's a good time to be reminded of that and get into the routine of it. So hopefully that it sticks throughout the year.
Exactly.
And into next year, I should say, not just the remainder of this year.
Maybe we have Walktober and Aquatober, and then we have Givember.
Givember. We'll workshop the name.
Yeah. Thanks for listening to Young House Love Has a Podcast. And 10 points if you noticed me say that I have a wide girth in bed instead of a wide berth. I got 99 idiom problems, and that's apparently one of them.
And if you like our podcast, there are two easy free ways to support it. One, tell a friend or family member, and two, leave a rating or review. Easy peasy.
And you know we love hearing what you do while you listen, like Betsy, who heard the ad about how people can remember the name Agility Mattress by thinking about dog agility courses while she was on her way to dog agility practice. A full circle moment.
Yes, and head over to this week's show notes at younghouselove.com/podcast to see some examples of the places where we display and wrangle our kids' artwork, along with a link to that impact driver I'm digging.
We'll also put some pictures of my new plant babies and those articles about which ones are best for indoor air quality.
Later.
Bye.
I'll say that the episode inspired me to make a change in that sometimes, you know, we'll send like flowers as a gift to someone. Is that Sneezy the plant?
I tried to make that really quiet. That's why it's so funny, because it was so loud. I was like, I'll just tuck my chin and go, and it was